It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we find out what it's like to go from being exonerated for a crime you didn't commit to being a lawyer representing others who may also be wrongfully convicted people.
First, President Trump's newest immigration ban is facing its first major legal challenge after Hawaii filed a lawsuit against it in federal court this week. The newest order bans travelers, immigrants, and refugees from six Muslim-majority countries.
Members of President Trump's cabinet have stood by the updated executive order, but the Hawaiian Attorney General has called it, quote, the Muslim ban 2.0, and the state's lawsuit calls into question whether the order is constitutional.
This afternoon, the Attorney General of Washington announced an upcoming suit against that ban, and the Attorney General of New York plans to join Washington's suit. Nahal Tusi is with us now to talk about the lawsuits and the new ban. She's a foreign affairs reporter at Politico. Nahal, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the new lawsuits, Nahal, this is the second executive order from President Trump on this issue, placing restrictions on travelers. We know one difference. Iraq is now off the list, seven countries down to six. What other big differences are there in the two incarnations of this order?
Well, generally speaking, it appears to be more tailored, more limited. It doesn't ban Syrian refugees indefinitely. It simply bans all refugees temporarily. You're right, Iraq's been taken off the list, but there are still six other predominantly Muslim countries. They've also removed language that appeared to give a preference to religious minorities, basically Christians, who would have been seeking refugee status. And also they made it very clear that the order does not apply to green card holders, also known as lawful permanent residents. So generally speaking, they tried to do this. They insist, the administration does, that the earlier order was perfectly legal and perfectly fine. But, you know, they've also put this out, and it suggests through their actions that perhaps they were a bit worried about some of what was in the earlier order.
This was one intent, it seems like, was to make it more lawsuit-proof, I guess. We're seeing now these new legal challenges trying to stop this before it starts next week. What are the grounds for that challenge from Hawaii?
Well, Hawaii just feels like it's basically the same type of general setup in terms of discrimination against Muslims and others, even if it doesn't necessarily specify that in the new language. And my understanding is Washington State also is filing a motion that basically are saying that at the end of the day, it's still the same thing, and they haven't quite proven why we need to do this to protect the United States.
And what was the reasoning for Iraq coming off of that list?
Well, this is really interesting. It kind of goes to show how having more political pull in Washington can make a difference. Iraqis argued that, look, we are actually your allies in the fight against Islamist terrorism. We are helping you fight the Islamic State in our country. And they just felt like it was very insulting on a lot of levels to them. And technically, Iraq is an ally of the United States, and to be put on the list was pretty alarming to a lot of people. At the same time, a lot of folks who work for the Pentagon and for state were particularly alarmed at Iraq's inclusion because so many Iraqi translators have been waiting for visas, special visas, to come to the United States because they had helped U.S. troops, in some cases for years, in Iraq. And so they felt like this was such a slap in the face to people over there who had been helping the United States.
Talking to Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs reporter at Politico, looking at President Trump's newest incarnation of the executive order, the so-called travel ban, now affecting six Muslim-majority countries. Nahal, in a recent piece, you wrote that there could be a spillover effect in this order that could affect travelers from a lot of other countries and maybe ultimately travelers from the United States going elsewhere. What do you see there?
Yeah, this is one of the most fascinating and overlooked part of this order, which is that there are provisions in it that say that the U.S. is going to be looking at our visa agreements with every country all over the world and seeing if they stand up, if all of these countries are giving us the information that we want in order to vet all of their citizens. And if there are any cases where we feel like we're not getting the information we need, then those countries, too, might be added to the banned list, basically. And also, one other thing to note is that those six countries that are temporarily banned from sending their people here, they are supposed to meet new conditions so that they are no longer banned. But the problem is that some some of those countries, Syria, for example, or Yemen, their state structure barely exists. They're in the mired in wars, or in the case of Iran, they don't have diplomatic relations with the U.S. So for a lot of countries, the idea that they will ever meet these conditions that the Trump folks are going to be placing on them is highly questionable. So some of these temporary bans can end up being permanent, and a number of other countries could wind up being placed on the ban list. And at the same time, because visa programs are supposed to be reciprocal, other countries in the world might say, well, you know what, if you're going to demand our people's information, then we want more information from your people. And it could just end up backfiring and leading to a lot of retaliation. And so American travelers might, in the long run, get affected.
That'll be a part of the story to watch in the future. I want to give a listen to Attorney General Jeff Sessions talking about the ban and the case to be made for it as part of our national security efforts.
The Department of Justice believes that this executive order, just as the first executive order, is a lawful and proper exercise of presidential authority. This Department of Justice will defend and enforce lawful orders of the President consistent with the core principles of our Constitution. The executive is empowered under the Constitution and by Congress to make national security judgments and to enforce our immigration policies in order to safeguard the American public.
Nihal, can you talk about this travel ban as a security measure? I mean, most of the countries here, a lot of the countries are failed states, plus or minus a little bit. There is definitely terrorist activity in many of these countries. Iran, the Attorney General has pointed out, classified as a state sponsor of terrorism. Do these changes, does this travel ban impact our national security?
Well, in the sense that if you simply don't let people in to the United States, then you are, yes, reducing the potential threat to the U.S. down to zero, because those people just can't come here. But in the long run, actually, there's an argument that it could hurt American national security as well, because you're basically fanning anti-American sentiment. Take the case of Iran. Like, yes, Iran is considered a state sponsor of terrorism, but Iranian citizens themselves, for the most part, are not engaged in terrorism. And among the six countries, Iranians make up more than half of the number of people who get visas to come to this country, and in some cases to live here. A lot of them are just tourist visas. But for a lot of the folks, now they're basically barred from the United States indefinitely. But a lot of Iranians, the ordinary Iranians, are actually very pro-American. It's one of the more pro-American countries in the Middle East, despite their government. And so now you sent a signal to the Iranian people that, hey, America doesn't want you either. And that actually could really strengthen hardliners in Iran. And those hardliners in the government might go about doing more things that undermine U.S. national security, if not directly on U.S. soil, then perhaps in Iraq, for instance, where Iranians are fighting the Islamic State parallel to the Americans and have yet to attack the Americans, but perhaps could, attack us now. So there's a lot at play here and a lot of things that are interlinked. And sometimes I think it's so simple to simply say, well, if we just don't let them in, then it's over, then the threat is gone. But actually, it could prove to be much more complicated than that.
Getting back to the lawsuits, first from Hawaii, now Washington and New York, I want to ask you to predict the outcome of any given lawsuit, but is there a sense that, yes, this thing is going to kick in when scheduled, or there's a good chance of court delays?
There's a possibility of a court delay, but from what I can tell, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but this new executive order is much more carefully drawn up. And one of the reasons that I think that perhaps there's more hesitation among some of the other states who were really angry over the first order is that you're not seeing as many line up this time to file a lawsuit on this. Some of them say that we're still studying it. We're still trying to figure out what to do. At the end of the day, one thing is really, kind of a bedrock principle that has been for a long time, which is that the executive branch really does have a lot of say on immigration policy, and they really can go pretty far in terms of how they decide to set the lines. And so it's really fascinating, actually, to see the Republicans now, like Jeff Sessions and others, defend this order and defend the president's right to set immigration policy when they were attacking Barack Obama for setting immigration policy in a different way by, for instance, slowing down deportations or giving protection to the children, the dreamers, the so-called dreamers who are in this country. And then they were saying, no, the president's overstepping his executive authority. But now they're saying, no, the president has lots of executive authority. So that's one of the most fascinating dynamics here in terms of the immigration law.
Nahal, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs reporter for Politico. She joined us today to talk about Hawaii's lawsuit against the Trump administration over the newest travel ban, which prevents travelers and refugees from six Muslim-majority countries from coming to the U.S., also seeing challenges now from Washington and New York. Jarrett Adams was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17. After serving nearly a decade in prison, he was exonerated and released. Jarrett was a guest on this show last year to talk about his story after it was featured in the book Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity.
Jarrett is now an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York and focuses on issues like prison reform and wrongful convictions. Just last month, Adams made his first appearance in Wisconsin court as an attorney representing a client who says that he was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault. Jarrett Adams joins us now. Jarrett, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you all for having me.
Well, you have been down the road that ends in an overturned conviction yourself. Briefly, can you remind us what happened?
I was wrongfully convicted of a sexual assault, falsely accused, after a consensual encounter. And a story evolved of, me and two men sneaking up a flight of stairs and raping someone and fleeing a building. And the only problem was it wasn't true, and there were witnesses who were able to create a timeline of events that made it absolutely impossible. These were witnesses that, were never at my trial. I had a public defender assigned to me, and, at 17, 18, never being accused of being in any trouble at all, my parents and myself, we didn't know the difference between a good defense and a bad defense. The only thing I kept saying was, look, I didn't do it. It isn't true. We were there at this party the entire day, entire night, and I couldn't really think in terms of how important a timeline to events and stuff like that was. And it took a huge chunk out of my life only to be my conviction to be reversed, all the charges be dismissed, and, me to be released without a record. But, there's a 10-year gap in my resume now.
What was the process like? I mean, 10 years is a big chunk of time, as you just said. Do you remember clearly what it was like going through those 10 years to get to the eventual overturned conviction?
Yeah, it was an evolution process. I mean, I got the opportunity to see, at first I thought, this is just a black and white thing. I had a white accuser, and I felt like, my case was completely overshadowed with the racial undertones. And I felt like going into prison, it was all about race. But I quickly realized that, the criminal justice system doesn't discriminate by color. It discriminates by resources. And it's a bottom feeder of those who can't afford to get a defense or don't even know what a defense is. I met so many people while in prison who were there because they pled guilty or were either found guilty, not because they were guilty, but because they couldn't afford an adequate defense.
Obviously, you're a lawyer now. You know exactly what you're talking about. You understand the difference between a good defense and a bad defense. But when did you decide that you had an affinity for the law and that you were going to pursue it, even if from behind bars?
I mean, if I can get the listeners to see the pain and anguish etched across my mother's forehead in the visiting room, I think that would be enough to get anyone over whatever hump it is in front of them that they say they can't get over. I was inspired, by her strength to continue to support me and drive, so many miles to come and see me in these prisons, which are often, upstate and away from society itself. And so I left in debt. And I told myself that, when she goes to church, now that I'm out, she won't look down and cry anymore. And if there are tears, it would be tears of joy. So I started to work, went to school, and I was able to do this. And she made me promise her that I didn't just go off into the sunset with a career and aspirations to make money, but I practiced law and leave behind a legacy of helping others who were just like the situation that me and her was in.
How old were you when you got out?
I was 26 and I was turning 27 years old. So, at 17, turning 18, arrested, And I was like, all my other friends were going off and going to college, and they were sending letters and you know, showing me pictures of their first cars. You know, I was in prison with a mandatory release of 2019 for a rape case that had absolutely no evidence besides an allegation. And, you know, when I got out, I just felt like, you know, so much time had been missed. There was no way I was going to be able to make that time back up. And even the process when I got out was extremely difficult. And it took me a while before I realized that I needed therapy and I needed help. I needed to talk to someone and released all of my anger and frustration to allow me to turn that anger and frustration into the fuel that drove me to where I am today.
Do you think that the resources are there, including, as you said, mental health counseling, financial aid? Are those there for other people like yourself?
It has to be. And the reason that I say that it has to be is because what we are doing in society is this. Most of the people who go to prison, they're coming home someday, right? So we're basically, as taxpayers, we're investing so much money to warehouse people instead of correcting them. And when we warehouse them for decades at a time and we release them, we're releasing them where? Right back into our community. So it would behoove us in society to figure out a way to find the necessary funds to make sure that the people that we are sending to prison are really getting the resources they need to correct themselves, because it's not happening at all.
What do you think about the amount of financial compensation people who have been found to be wrongfully convicted get? There's been a lot of focus on this in the past several years, saying that what a lot of states have set aside for someone who's released after being wrongfully convicted is not enough to restart a life. What do you say?
I mean, it's definitely not. And I would say this. When we think in terms of compensation, we need to stop thinking in terms of monetary compensation, because the most important compensation a person can have is physical and mental health care once they come home. From you know, prisons aren't country yards. Like they you know, nothing great happens in prison at all. And even if you aren't attacked or anything like that, you can't erase what your eyes see. And it takes a psychological toll and effect on the person. And what happens with that person when they come home? Well, you got to ask your question, what is home? And home is not your home, because you've been locked up for so long. So a family member, you may be fortunate to have a family member who allows you to come into their home and make it your home. But at the same time, that burden falls on that family as well. And so, you know, it's a holistic approach that needs to be taken with the criminal justice system. I think that in society, we've allowed ourselves to believe that every time a person is accused or walks across the screen with a pair of handcuffs on, we don't ask ourselves, what is he accused of? We immediately say, what did he do?
We're talking with Jarrett Adams right now. He was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17 years old. After serving nearly a decade in prison, he was exonerated. He's now an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York and focuses on issues like prison reform and wrongful convictions. And right now, you're representing a Wisconsin man who says he was wrongfully convicted of a sexual assault. Can you tell us about that case?
Well, this is another case where, you know, all the hallmarks are there when you look at these cases where the justice system can get it wrong. You know, Richard Berenick was accused of a crime while he had six alibi witnesses who showed that he was in a different state. He was nowhere near the state of Wisconsin. He was in West Virginia, I believe, somewhere at the time of this assault. Not only did he have the six witnesses to show that he was in that state, he also applied for food stamps while staying with his sister. He was struggling to find work in Wisconsin. His mother put him on a bus to go to live with his sister for a few months to find work, because her husband was a construction guy, and he was able to provide him some work. So while there, she told Richard, she says, look, you know, there's a lot of mouths to feed in this house, so we need to get you on food stamps. They applied for food stamps, and luckily they kept the receipt of that. So we had that, along with the six witnesses, at his trial. And it still wasn't enough to go against the state's witness, who produced a federal agent who stood before the jury and said that a hair found at the scene had similarities to a hair of Richard. Decades later, we found out that science was junk, and the FBI issued an order and told the federal agents who testified to stop testifying in this manner. So now that brings us forward all the way to right now, where
not only did we have the junk science of the evidence influence the jury's outcome, but now we've been able to test these hairs in the case. And these hairs exclude Richard Baranek from being at the scene of this crime. And so now we have that. We have already what we had before, the six witnesses. And we have the FBI agent's testimony we know was false. And so here we are, and we have to fight tooth and nail to just get him in front of a jury again to hear this evidence.
So what happens next in that case?
I mean, we are basically in a briefing period right now. We have presented the expert witnesses who were able to testify to what they did as far as the testing goes. And now we're briefing, we're briefing little issues concerning, in my opinion, it's just really concerning chain of custody. So right now the argument isn't the results. No one is arguing the results that exclude Mr. Baranek. Right now we're arguing about, who touched this evidence? Where did it go from there? Well, who was the mailman who delivered it? So it's just absolutely ridiculous what we're doing right now. And each day that goes past is an innocent man not only being in prison, but if this woman was raped as she claims that she was, well, then we have someone who raped a lady that is still roaming free right now in the community.
And, Jared, just briefly, we're just about out of time, but you're working alongside Wisconsin Innocence Project co-founder Keith Finley, who represented you in your wrongful conviction case. What is it like to have come full circle like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's surreal, just getting the opportunity to sit next to Keith. When I heard him argue my case in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, I was actually in handcuffs inside of a room listening to a phone on the wall as he argued my case and advocated for my innocence and to overturn my conviction. And, you know, here it is. It's 10 years later to the month that I was released, and I am practicing law beside him. And so it's a very surreal feeling, but it's also an inspiring feeling, I hope, to not just, you know, those who are close to me, but others who are listening as well, to understand that there will always be obstacles in life. We have to either go around, go over, or go right through them.
And, Jared, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Jared Adams there. He's an attorney now. He was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, medication can play a big role in recovery from heroin addiction, but there are a lot of obstacles to getting the right prescription in Wisconsin. We'll find out why and what changes might be in the works.
First, as the Trump administration continues to work toward tougher enforcement of immigration laws, there's been concern in some industries about the role of undocumented workers. A recent study from Pew Research finds that undocumented workers are most heavily represented in service and construction industries.
Undocumented workers also play a well-known role in agriculture. While farming isn't the most common job for undocumented immigrants, they make up the bigger portion of the labor pool in farming than in any other sector. According to the Pew study, unauthorized immigrants make up more than a quarter of the industry's workforce, and another 20% are legal immigrants.
Our next guest looked into the potential impact of tougher immigration enforcement on farmers and food prices in recent pieces for Modern Farmer magazine. Brian Barth is a writer-at-large for Modern Farmer. We have his latest article on the topic linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Well, we gave a couple numbers there, but how dependent is our farming in the United States on these undocumented workers?
Well, I heard the numbers that you just gave, and I think those are certainly accurate, but it also depends on which aspects of farm work you're discussing. So if you're talking about field work, which is the harvest, you know, the picking, the weeding, the sowing of the seeds, that tends to be done more by itinerant workers, the estimates of undocumented workers in that category are closer to 50 to 70% of the workforce. So it's primarily done by undocumented workers.
So why are we in this situation where this major, I think people would say vital, food industry is so heavily dependent on people who are, in at best, a legal gray area, at worst, at risk of deportation?
Well, I think there's two things. I think one is the low wage aspect and cheap food, that Americans have come to expect low food prices. We have some of the lowest food prices in the world relative to our income. So that's part of it. And then I think the other part of it is cultural. You know, farm work is less desirable, arguably, than, you know, flipping burgers at the local fast food joint or, you know, running the cash register at Walmart. So those other low-paying jobs, which actually often pay even less than farm work in some instances, are more desirable for American workers.
Well, you looked, you reported on a particular family of Mexican immigrants, most of the family undocumented. Can you describe the kind of work they did and the life they lived doing farm work?
Sure. They were part of the East Coast migrant labor circuit, which in the wintertime would be based in Florida, the citrus industry, and winter vegetables that are grown at that time of year. And then they sort of move up the East Coast with, you know, the spring and summer and fall harvest, you know, all the way up to Michigan and Maine. And then they go back down to Florida for the winter. And they are primarily pickers. They're primarily picking produce.
And this is not gardening. This is actually very physically demanding work,
sure.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, they usually start at sunrise, and they go until, you know, the crop is picked and the foreman, you know, calls it a day, or, you know, until their bodies give out, is how he described it to me.
And they don't have a lot of recourse. So you write that in some cases, workers in this situation, undocumented, farms can simply not pay them. They can exploit them in various ways. And there's obviously nowhere to go for them to file a grievance on that.
Right. And it's not that there aren't laws against that. It's, you know, largely a matter of enforcement. And when you lack legal status, you're very unlikely to seek legal recourse, you know, for the obvious reasons, much less even just knowing how to navigate that system, even if you did want to risk deportation. That wage theft is a really huge issue a lot of undocumented immigrants and documented immigrant farm workers complain of that.
Talking to Brian Barth, writer-at-large from Modern Farmer. He's been writing about the role of undocumented laborers in American farming. There's an issue around the country here in Wisconsin, the dairy industry included in that. Brian, one question that comes up is, why don't the farmers or the farm operations in question bring in people with these H-2A visas, and why don't the workers get those visas or participate in those visa programs instead of having this illegal situation?
Right. I don't have the stats off the tip of my tongue, but a very tiny percentage of farm labor is supplied through the H-2A visa system, which is the U.S. government's current method for bringing in laborers temporarily from other countries, primarily Mexico. Both farmers and the workers and worker advocacy groups have a lot of complaints about it. Farmers find it bureaucratically burdensome. You know, when you need a field of tomatoes harvested, you don't necessarily know 6 months in advance, you know, which week of July it's going to, you know, be ready for harvest. But it may take 6 months, you know, in order to have your application processed and actually get lined up to receive workers. So it's very cumbersome for the type of work that is entailed in farming. And it's not like if you're living in Mexico and you really want to come to the United States to work and, you know, create a better life for yourself, it's not that you can really just go and apply for an H-2A visa. It really is instigated from U.S. farm employers who basically use contractors that go into Mexico and recruit workers. Those workers generally have to pay a pretty significant fee to the contractor for that service, which typically includes transportation to the U.S. and then transportation back at the end of the visa. So it's tightly controlled and it has been compared to indentured servitude. the farm worker is bound to that one employer. They can't quit if they're not satisfied with the conditions. Well, they could quit, but they would basically face deportation at that point unless they immediately went back to their home country. But they don't tend to, just because they have few other options. You know, they would basically have a legal status at that point if they were to quit.
You wrote about some industry group studies looking at what would happen if deportation is stepped up, border wall, tougher security, that sort of thing, without providing legal alternatives for foreign workers in agriculture. What did these agricultural industry groups find out? What are they worried about?
Yeah, you know, this is not a new topic. This has been going on for many years. There is a big effort at immigration overhaul, you know, that kind of came to a head in 2013 and basically fizzled out without anything happening. So there were a lot of studies and investigation into different strategies to deal with undocumented immigration, one of which being, you know, what they call the enforcement-only strategy, which is, you know, pretty much what the Trump administration's approach is, basically keep them out, you know, get the ones that are here out and keep them from returning. You know, and others were a combination of enforcement and overhauling the H-2A system to allow more workers in. But that enforcement-only strategy, which is looks like where we're headed at the moment, would cause, you know, tremendous hardship. I mean, forget about the workers themselves for a minute, but the farm employers would suffer tremendous hardship in terms of labor shortages, crops rotting in the field, loss of income, and then, of course, that translates down the line to the grocery store and the, you know, the produce that we have available and what it costs. The cost increases would depend somewhat on the type of food product we're talking about. Actually, dairy was one of the ones that the costs were found to be most impacted by that scenario, something like I think a 90% increase in retail milk prices was what the study found. Other types of food were less impacted, but all would go up to a certain extent. And, you know, in a way, it's like, well, most Americans could afford to pay 10% more on their grocery bill. You know, like, they wouldn't starve. And so one could argue, you know, that's a solution, is, you know, kind of rejigger the system to make food cost a little more and use that extra economic incentive to smooth out the labor system. However, on the flip side, a 10% increase in grocery bills for someone who is unemployed and reliant on SNAP benefits, for example, actually is a pretty big impact and actually can, you know, cause someone to miss a meal. So both of those have to be looked at.
We're talking to Brian Barth from Modern Farmer, looking at the role of undocumented workers in American farming and what a crackdown could mean for farms and for food prices.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Undocumented workers are about a quarter of the American farm workforce, according to Pew Research. Are you worried about a labor shortage if more of those workers are deported? How should their labor be replaced, if so? And do we need more legal paths for foreign workers to work in agriculture? If you work in farming, what's your experience when it comes to undocumented workers? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Brian Barth from Modern Farmer magazine about undocumented workers in American agriculture and the potential impact of increased immigration enforcement.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on immigration law as it exists, as it could exist, and the role these often undocumented workers play in American farming? If you are in agriculture yourself, would particularly like to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Brian, before we go to our callers, you wrote about Georgia. They kind of tried this. There was a crackdown. What happened to agriculture in the state of Georgia?
Well, there was a lot of reports of labor shortages, basically. you know, farmers trying to find local native-born workers and, you know, not having great success, crops rotting in the field, you know, people showing up and then maybe lasting a half a day or a couple days and then quitting. And that's been seen time and time again. There was a very extensive study in North Carolina several years ago where they sort of tracked the recruitment efforts, a state labor office basically, you know, recruiting farm workers during a time of very high unemployment during the Great Recession. And, you know, a tiny number of the hundreds of thousands of unemployed North Carolinians actually applied for farm jobs. Very few actually showed up, and virtually none of them finished the season that year. So, you know, it would be great if, you know, farmers could employ more native-born Americans. You know, that's one possibility, but it just doesn't seem to happen even where unemployment is very high.
Let's go to our callers now. Chris is on the line in Madison. Chris, hi.
Yeah, and I got to say that I grew up farming, and I used to ride my bike, you know, all over the country helping out the different farmers, you know, as a 12-year-old. And now as a father, I look for employment for my teenage and young teenage sons, and I can't find it because of the changes in the ag industry related to this topic. And I think that there's a number of systems in play here, but one of which is, number one, we need to be teaching our children the value of hard work. And yeah, there are too many people who just don't want to do hard work, even because they can fall back on unemployment or some other government benefit. We need to employ more younger workers so that they learn the value of an actual hard day's work, and then pay them as such. And when you go to the grocery store, you buck up and you pay $4.55 for a gallon of milk, because you know what, it takes a lot of effort to produce milk.
Chris, thanks for the call. A lot there, Brian. We need to have a better attitude toward hard work, because this farm work is, I don't think anybody would argue, this is hard work. But also, he says, be willing to pay more for the food, so we'd be willing to pay more for the workers. What do you think about that kind of sticker shock, $4.50, $5 for a gallon of milk, for example?
Well, like I said, I think most Americans can afford it as long as, you know, there are safety nets for those that can't. There are a lot of efforts underway to create fair food labels, so kind of like the organic label or a fair trade label. A fair food label would indicate that food, that, you know, that food chain for whatever the product was had been audited by an external group to say, okay, you know, these workers are being paid fairly, living wages, or, you know, they have good working conditions, they have an opportunity to communicate with their employers about their needs. Unfortunately, none of those labels have reached the status of fair trade or certified organic, and I think that's kind of the next frontier, is making that happen. And how that's going to happen, I'm not sure. I think it takes, you know, discussions like this in public to bring more awareness and you know, for people to start looking for those labels, because they are out there, but they're not widely available and they're not widely known.
Chris, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Rick on the line in Baraboo. Rick, hi.
Hi. I was wondering what would happen if we actually enforced existing laws that say employers cannot hire illegals. Perhaps larger fines and or jail time might simply prevent the hiring of illegal workers, and it might also do a couple other things, such as putting more pressure on Congress to ease the transition for these workers so they could work for these farmers, or the farmers could find out that, hey, fines are expensive, jail time isn't what I want, I'm going to start paying more money, and I can then get natural-born workers.
Rick, thanks for the call. So, Brian, let's start with that first point. A lot of the enforcement we hear about focuses on undocumented workers themselves. Rick's saying more enforcement on, in this case, the farmers, the people employing them. Is there any talk of that?
You know, that hasn't been at the top of the Trump agenda. I think that has been certainly part of the immigration discussion. You know, there are mechanisms in place. Enforcement is difficult, takes a lot of manpower. I don't think there's a ton of political will to do it, honestly, because people really recognize that certain industries truly depend on illegal labor. And so I think people recognize that the first step is probably to, you know, make it a little bit easier to hire people legally rather than crack down on people for illegal hiring. That's where it is at the moment. You know, people have talked about that for years. There are those laws on the books, but I think there's not a lot of political will to really crack down and enforce them. And instead, we're just talking about, you know, more sweeping out any illegal individuals that the ICE can find, and, you know, tightening security on the border is what's being talked about at the moment. But I do really hold out hope that this, you know, intense debate that's going on right now will really force the hand of Congress to reopen this immigration overhaul file that was closed several years ago in futility, and make it happen this time. That, you know, it almost got there. There were reasonable solutions. The different groups, you know, came to compromises, but ultimately, you know, the votes were not there, and it was not passed.
Back to our callers as we talk to Brian Barth from Modern Farmer. We'll go to Lee on the line in Madison now. Lee, hi.
Hi. Yeah, as far as the guy calling in wanting to implement children into the farming industry, I grew up on the farm, and as a child did a lot of work on the farm. I suffer from a back injury due to pitching pig poop, actually, 13, 14 years old, 15 years old. Farming is very hard work, and it is no place for children to be in. You have PTO shafts, you got tractors. The accident rates on farms are astronomical, and then he wants to implement children. He's a fool.
Lee, thanks for the call. And Brian, I mean, the reality is for a lot of these migrant families, their families working on it, and that includes children, right?
Sure. Yeah, the federal labor rules for agricultural labor are fundamentally different from all other types of labor. This started back in the 1930s. It had to do with, you know, the culture at the time where most of farm labor was done by the extended family. And so, you know, children were allowed to work. You didn't necessarily have to pay them. You know, that was kind of normal at that time. Now conditions are a little bit different, but a lot of those same laws are still on the books. I certainly agree, actually, with the previous caller, you know, suggesting not children, but let's say college-age mm-hmm. students on their summer break, you know, programs to get those folks working on farms, I think, is a great idea, you know, to introduce Americans to you know, what it means to grow food. And there is quite a bit of that in the organic farming world, not so much in conventional farming, but organic farming internships are, you know, a huge thing among the college-age crowd, and it would be great to see that expand.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Brian Barth. His Modern Farmer article on undocumented farm workers is linked over on the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, you can share your thoughts on the topic and maybe your experiences working on the farm, maybe employing migrant workers, maybe as a migrant worker yourself. Again, find that article, share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah. It's the final day of the big event, the United States Championship Cheese Contest, held in the Lambeau Field Atrium. And Wisconsin is dominating the competition for the grand prize.
Just over 2,300 cheeses, butters, and yogurts were submitted to the event. The cheese category was narrowed down to 20. The winner to be announced tonight of those 20, 13 were from Wisconsin cheesemakers.
Finalists include a bunch of cheddar, some goat cheese, a handful of goudas, and some more.
I don't want to read the complete list because we'll get too hungry. The winner, though, the big prize, is scheduled to be announced at an event that starts tonight at 6:30.
We're a little late here, but if the contest organizers need some cheese-loving radio hosts, say, to try some cheese, judge some cheese, maybe break a tie, we could be there.
We're there. We can get on the road to Green Bay. I think we can make, well, maybe not. Maybe not. Plus, we have the show to do.
Get off the show. Drive.
Yeah, I don't see it happening, but maybe we can just have our own cheese contest. We don't need the fans. We'll just bring in a bunch of cheese and eat it and decide what we like.
I like that during our interviews. What could go wrong?
Yeah, dairy and radio hosting doesn't always mix well for me. You can handle it.
You know what? I'd be willing to risk that. It's cheese.
All right. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.